Welcome to the Central Assembly Podcast. You're about to hear another inspirational message from Dr. Jim Bradford. It's our prayer that this message is an encouragement and blessing to your life.
We're in a series called Living the Jesus Paradoxes. The first one is really the most foundational. I believe that was like 3 weeks ago. Simply, Jesus talked about down being up. And that seems to be the hinge point for everything else. If we humble ourselves under his mighty hand, he will exalt us in due time. And out of that, dying is living. Last week we looked at little is big. No math illustrations today, but I will go this Wednesday night. We will go back to faith, science, and wonder again. We had a lot of fun last Wednesday night. But today is least is greatest, least is greatest. And Jesus addresses this head on in Matthew 20, 25. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." So do you agree with me that we welcome the heart-shaping work of God's Spirit through his word today? Amen. You may be seated. The heart we all have has a problem. In fact, this problem's as old as the human heart. So I call the me first problem. And this is what Jesus slams away at in this next paradox, that whereas for us, the greatest is the guy in charge, it's the woman who has the final word, and runs an organization. But Jesus said, in the way I look at things, and actually, this turns out to be, although I'm not talking mainly about leadership this morning, this turns out to be leadership genius. The four verses we just read represent the highest of what you will see in leadership books in the corporate world today, how to bring out the best in people, how to motivate people, how to all of us can be what we really need to be. This is an amazing, amazing passage that Jesus gives us when he talks about the least being greatest. But it does hit right at the me first problem. The me first problem is as old as Adam and Eve. When it was between God's way and their way, they picked their way, of course. Even Jesus' closest team, his 12 disciples, they were on a road trip to Capernaum one day. And they hung back from Jesus, hoping they were out of earshot, because they were arguing, can you believe this, a group of grown men, they were arguing about who is where in the pecking order, who is greatest. They were like boys with beards on, fighting on the playground about who is king of the castle. I mean, that's just like our hearts. And then Mama Zebedee comes along, whose sons, James and John, were two of those 12. She comes up to Jesus, actually just before these verses we read, and she said, "Jesus, you got a problem. When you get to your kingdom, you'll only have a right hand and a left hand, the seats of honor. But you got 12 guys here, so let me help you out with this. My two boys." Here's what the me first problem sounds like today. Number one, the truth is what I want it to be. The vast majority of Americans believe that. Truth is not absolute. It's what I would prefer it to be, what I want it to be, what I would like it to be. Someone said, you know, God created us in his image, and we've decided to return the favor. and recreate him in our image. That's the epitome of the me's first problem. Truth is what I want it to be. Or I'm entitled to special privileges. Now, I didn't say I enjoy special privileges. Personally, I have very high status because I travel so much. I have very high status with one of the U.S. airlines, and I have very high status with one of the U.S. hotel chains. And believe me, I love perks. And they give them to me. But I cross a line when I start living like, you know what? I'm entitled to people treating me in ways they don't treat other people. I'm entitled to special privileges. Some people live with that belief. Or anything I do must ultimately benefit me. I don't volunteer for anything unless it directly benefits me. I don't do anything extra at work unless it directly benefits me. Anything I do must ultimately benefit me. That's me first. Or one I hear leaders say a lot, actually. My team is here to make me look good. You know, I get what they're saying. I have some sympathy with that. Because if your team is not making you look good, if your team is making you look bad, you probably have to deal with it. But I love the team. I got Pastor Carter, Pastor Anthony, Pastor Don sitting right here in the front row. I get together. The problem is, if I'm sitting there in my office having conversations with them during the week, and I am obsessed with the thought, I wonder how they are making me look good, then something's terribly wrong. That's not how Jesus thinks. The question is, how can I help them succeed, not how are they helping me look good? So I don't buy totally into my team's here to make me look good. Also, here's another way the me first problem reveals itself. I rarely give money away. Why? Because everything I have is for me first. So I rarely give money away. I've heard millennials say that. I've heard older people say that, actually. Takes a lot, Pastor, for me to ever give away a dollar. Or people who disagree with me are my enemies. That's because the disagreement you personalize, because you're the king of your castle. And if someone disagrees with you, you take it as an offense. That's why we can't listen to each other anymore in our culture. We just get angry. Because, you know, everything's got to agree with what I think. Otherwise, I get angry, and those people must be against me, and they are my enemies. This is all a symptom of something that's very distant from the heart of Jesus. Or, sorry, this list is so long. I actually cut it way down. I'll neglect others to protect myself because it's me first. It's my welfare first. So I'm actually willing to walk away from needs in order to protect my reputation, in order to protect what I own, in order to protect what I have. Or the last one I chose, controlling people is how I get my way, because it's me first. And so who cares about other people? I just control them. I have subtle ways of doing that. I threaten people. I'm not saying I try not to do this, but I'm speaking hypothetically. This is what the me first problem sounds like inside of us. I get my way. Usually I get my way all the time, and I do it by controlling people. I do it by threatening them, by intimidating them, by pushing them around. I've heard people say proudly, you know, I'm kind of a bossy person. Yeah, I like to push people around. Well, that's actually a symptom of the me first problem. And in fact, that controlling people is how I get my way, that's the one Jesus picked up on. As soon as Mama Zebedee has done her speech about her two boys compared to all these other losers that are following Jesus around, Jesus called them together. Verse 25, again. Jesus called them together and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. So he's picking up on the way we get our way in life, the way the me first attitude makes us overly controlling in our relationships. And I guarantee you, every relationship that you're controlling, you're also smothering that relationship and choking the life out of it. We just think we can change people, and we think that we need to take responsibility for other people's feelings and other people's behavior. One of the things that's really helped me in my marriage is that I can influence my wife, but I can't take responsibility for how she behaves and how she feels. I can only take responsibility for me. And who am I to think that I have to impose my will on other human beings and control them? And he says, that's the way the Gentiles live. Now, who would have immediately gone to their mind when they heard the word Gentiles in the ancient Near East 2,000 years ago? It would have been the occupying empire, the Romans. And they know what Romans are like. They've got all kinds of pushy power. They've got all kinds of weapons. They can get you to do. They were pushing people around all the time. He said, pushing people around just to get what you want. He said, that's what the Gentiles do. But then get those amazing words. Not so with you. I wish some spiritual leaders would take Jesus seriously there. And there are corporate leaders that are killing their organizations because they're not empowering the people around them. They're just manipulating them and pushing them around and putting all the spotlight on themselves. I mean, this is leadership genius, but Jesus said, not so with you. It's not in my kingdom how it's done. Now, to understand this, we have to understand that relationships involve power, how we assert influence and how we treat the people around us, whether we treat them as if we are servants to them, or whether we treat them as if, in Jesus' words, we're lording it over them. And there's three kinds of power. I like the way Dick Foth kind of deals with this in his book, When the Giant Lies Down. There's three kinds of power that we have relationally in our lives. The first kind is positional power. Positional power. Like I have, you know, I think I have on my door, I have my name, and it probably says lead pastor underneath. So that says I have certain positional power. This is the influence, this is the authority you have to tell other people what to do because of your title, your position, your rank in the organization. Every parent knows about positional power. You tell your kid to do something. Well, we have two daughters, man, when they were young. But why? No, just do that. But why? Fourth time. But why? And there's where I would revert to positional power. Why? Because I'm the dad and you're not. End of conversation. So that's positional power. The second kind of power is possessional power. This is the influence and power you have because you possess something that other people don't. For instance, some nations possess weapons that other nations don't. That would be possessional power. Some people possess certain levels of education that others don't. Some people in an organization know things that other people don't. And sometimes they withhold information so they can leverage influence. That's possessional power. And, of course, some people, like in a church like ours or in organizations, they're just wealthier than other people. And often having more money than the people around you gives you leverage and gives you influence, rightly or wrongly. So that's possessional power. The third kind of power is personal power. Personal power. Now, personal power has to do with not your position and not with what you possess, but it has to do with who you are. Your integrity and your proven character, that carries more weight. I'll often, when I talk to pastors around the country, when I travel, I'll often say, you know, who you are will take you much farther than anything you do. Because this is where incredible power. Remember Billy Graham towards the end of his life? He didn't need to preach to one more crowd in any stadium without having incredible personal influence and authority. Because of proven track records, because of proven trustworthiness, because it's somebody who was passionate about something and lived true to it, and people admire that, and it's just irresistibly compelling when they see the real deal in you, and yet you're not about you. That there's something irresistibly compelling about that, and that's personal power. Now, in these three, I want you to notice that our insecurities and our pride tend to make us want to go up to positional power. Our insecurities and pride tend to push us up. But what Jesus is doing here in Matthew 20 is he's pushing us down from positional power. He said, notice the Gentiles, those old Romans, they lord it over you and get what they want, but not so among you, because Jesus is so concerned about what's happening in the personal level in your life. And so he keeps, whereas our egos keep pushing us up to positional power. I mean, I would love just to operate out of the positional power where I could just guilt you to death and say, I'm the pastor, so you better do what I say. I say to my wife, I'm the head of my house, so march, honey, and march fast. That has never worked, just for the record, but positional power has its limits. I mean, who wouldn't love to be the king of their castle and every time they bark, everybody around you jumps? I mean, that's just something so me first and carnal and broken and wicked in our hearts. But everything in our brokenness tends to push us up to operating out of positional power. We love being the boss. But everything in Jesus pulls us down to personal power. Personal power. So in Luke 22, Jesus tells a story. Let's read the verses and then I'll put it into a Springfield context. Luke 22, verse 27. Jesus said, this is another, of course, we're not in Matthew anymore. We're in another one of the Gospels. Jesus said, he asked the question, for who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who's at the table? But I am among you as one who serves. Now, we've got a few minutes left in the message yet, and what I'm going to do is a big risk, because you're going to get inordinately hungry really soon. When I was talking about pie, P-I, last week, some of you were telling me I got really hungry during that illustration. So I worry I'm going to distract you here, but I want you to picture your favorite restaurant in Springfield, okay? Think about your favorite restaurant in Springfield. And if Jesus was standing here and doing the same thing he did with his disciples in Luke 22, he'd be saying to us, okay, what's your favorite restaurant in Springfield? I want you to imagine walking into that restaurant and sitting down. Now, I want to ask you, there's two kinds of people. There's the customers and there's the waiters. So I want to ask you, who's more important to that restaurant, the customers or the waiters? We would say the customers. They're always right, even when they're wrong, and that's how the business survives, right? The customers. And Jesus said to them, you're right. The customers are more important. But I've come to be the waiter. That's what he said right there. But I've come to be the waiter. He's redefining greatness. He's pushing us down, not positional power, but he's pushing us down to personal power. I call this Jesus reducing us to greatness. Least is greatest is really the process of Jesus reducing us to greatness. It's a paradox. It makes no sense. It's even strange saying that. Jesus reduces us to greatness. But it's going to mean we do two things. I want to close with these. Jesus, when he, after saying, you know, those Gentiles, they just push you around. They operate out of positional power, and they operate out of possessional power because they have weapons you don't have, and they have painful ways of killing you that you don't have, so they can get their way. Jesus says, not going to be so among you. He's going to tell us the two things. we need to do. We need to renounce something, and we need to resolve something. And first of all, if we're going to be reduced to greatness, we need to renounce the myth. This is pretty obvious, but let me state it anyway. We need to renounce the myth that the world owes us something. You know, some of us are living with that myth. The world owes me something. So I'm just going to sort of wait around passively till my big break comes, because somebody, the world owes me my big break. The world owes me favors. The world owes me special treatment. The problem with that myth that the world owes you something is that you are probably the only person in your world this week that actually believes that. That's a tough myth to live with when nobody buys into it. I guarantee you, your roommate is not going to be obsessed this week with what they owe you. And so here's what Jesus says, verse 26 of Matthew 20, back there in this passage we started with. Not so with you. So there's those words again, lording it over people. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave. In other words, you have renounced the myth. You don't even live like anybody owes you anything. But I want to tell you, when you live with that myth that the world owes you something, you're going to end up very angry, because nobody is going to live up to what you think you're entitled to. That me first problem, it feels so seductive, it feels so wonderful, but it sets you up for disappointment and anger. If you are living preoccupied with what people are or are not doing for you, you'll never obviously be living like Jesus is calling us to live, and you'll never be happy, because people will keep disappointing you all the time. I tell you, I called it a myth, not a truth, the myth that the world owes you something. Nobody actually owes you very much. But instead, you turn the tables on it, and Jesus said, whoever wants to be great among you must be your what? Servant. Say that word with me. Servant. And whoever wants to, as if he's putting salt in the wound here, whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Yeah. Oh, that sounds very unfair, Lord. That's because of that powerful myth we live in. We ought to be treated certain ways, and the world owes us something. I once heard the executive director of Convoy of Hope, Hal Donaldson, speak. It was just about, I think, 4 years ago. It was a national meeting of Assemblies of God leaders. There were about 350 of us in the room. It's a group called the General Presbytery, all our district officers, leading pastors in the Assemblies of God from all over the country. And this was when I was serving as General Secretary with the Assemblies of God. And Hal Donaldson, we asked him to bring the devotional one day, and he spoke on this passage, actually. And I'll never forget. It was so simple, but it was so profound. Other people were just kind of, you know, staring at him, but I had to write this down. He said, when we are thinking more about how people are serving us than thinking about how we are serving them, then we're in a lot of trouble. That's amazing. If you just in an average day are just thinking a lot more about how people are serving you rather than thinking about the way you are serving others, then we've got things backwards. I was reading about a corporate guy. He wasn't a CEO. He didn't need to be for the kind, but he had incredible influence simply because he loved networking people. He had a pretty broad range of relationships, and so what he'd do is he, besides his responsibilities at work, he loved to convene luncheons where he just bring two people who don't know each other but are in the same fields, and he'd bring them and network them. And then he'd just let the conversation take on a life itself, and he didn't mind if he wasn't the center of conversation anymore. And some of the alliances, some of the corporate networking that took place just because a guy was not interested in what people are doing for him, but what could he do to advance the mission of other people and network them with people that would help them. So these are These are incredible things. We renounce the myth that the world owes us something. And once we've renounced that myth, you know, it leaves us no choice but to think about how we're serving others. This is where your personal power, this is not positional power. I don't care. You don't need a position. I know people who have incredible influence, and they don't have a leadership position. They don't have a title. It's also a myth to think I need a title. I have people say, well, when I get a paid staff position, and when they finally recognize me and give me an office and give me a title, then I can accomplish something. That is a bunch of baloney. You operate out of personal power before you operate out of any other power. I know people who have no titles, but they move whole organizations. They're the opinion shapers. Why? Because people see something in them that they love, and they've given their lives to lifting up everybody around them. And listen, if you just lift people up, if you don't read a book just for you, but whenever you read a book, you start thinking, who could I share this book with? How am I just networking people? How am I encouraging everybody around me? I want to tell you, you'll have more influence than the CEO of your company. That's just how this works. Servanthood is so powerful. So all the best corporate leadership stuff out there today is on servant leadership. I'm surprised how much the Bible now, how much Jesus gets quoted these days. In non-egocentric, level 5, servant-centered leaders who are the ones who are building the greatest companies because they're bringing the best out in people around them. You do it not by bossing people around, but by serving them. So we renounce the myth that the world owes us something. And let's shut this down here with one more. Here's the resolution. It's kind of like the other side of the servanthood coin. We then resolve to put more into life than we hope to take out of it. We resolve to put more into life than we ever hope to take out of it. That's not original to me. That was in a book written by an author by the name of J. Oswald Sanders, who wrote a classic little book on leadership many years ago entitled Spiritual Leadership. And when I used to work with my interns, when I was involved with a university church at the University of Minnesota, we'd always take our interns through this book. But this is the that's the one statement that to me made the price of the whole book worth it. He said, true spiritual leaders, true leaders, put more into life than they hope to take out of it. It was one of those revelation moments where I thought, what if right now, while I'm still in my 20s, what if I decided that I'm going to live the rest of my life that way? That, you know, it's counterintuitive, because when I buy something, I put a certain amount of money across the counter to get something that I hope is of equal or greater value back, right? I want to get back at least equal what I do. If I put 20 bucks across and I get back something that's only worth 10 bucks, I feel ripped off. But if I put 20 bucks across and buy something that's really worth 30 bucks, I got a bargain, hallelujah. And that we want a bargain, right? We want to get at least back what we invest. And I was reading this, I thought, that is so unlike me. That's so counterintuitive. But this could change my life. What if I actually lived, if God gave them to me, the next 50 years of my life, putting more into life than I expect to get back? Whew. And then Jesus said, I'm talking to you about servanthood because this is what I'm going to do. Just, verse 28, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. I just got to sit on that for a minute. What if we lived this way? What if we renounced the myth that the world owes us something? And what if instead of operating out of positional power, we resolve to put more into life than we hope to take out of it? I've noticed what people like that, I've had some of those people in my life who really, I think, do put more into life than they hope to take out of it. And you do it because you know you're a servant and you're being like Jesus and you're on a mission. You don't go to work, you're sent to work. You don't go to school, you're sent to school because you're God's person. And he has a way of taking care of you and helping you ironically walk into abundance. That's going to come in the next week or two. The thing is, a slave especially doesn't think, well, I'm not going to put more into this than I hope to take out of it. A slave knows they're going to get nothing out of this except maybe survival rations. It's not that way in the kingdom. This is the way you walk into abundance. Watch God take care of you. But you don't walk into it with me-centered, me-first preconceptions. This is how abundance, this is how walking in the Spirit is released in our lives. We renounce the myth that everybody owes me something, but I do make the resolution that I'm going to be a servant. I'm going to pour more into life than I hope to take out of it because I'm on a mission. I'm sent by Jesus. I notice people like that, they tend to do things without being asked. When you start thinking like this all the time, like the world doesn't owe me something, so I better take responsibility, but I'm not going to ask back. I'm not going to do things only because they benefit me. And I find people like that, you just have a radar. Servant-minded people have a radar, and they just see need and meet it without even being asked. And they, they don't count the thank you notes, like God had to deal with me at one time, I'm ashamed to say, in my life. I started counting thank you notes, and I was feeling as a pastor kind of unappreciated. I wasn't getting as much appreciation as I thought I deserved. I mean, I can't believe how wicked that is, but that was my heart a number of years ago. And the Spirit of God had to say, first of all, Bradford, I thought you were doing this for me and not for the appreciation. And so you better stop counting. I remember it was like a directive from the Holy Spirit. You better stop counting the thank you notes. So I appreciate thank you notes. Thank you. I appreciate them. But I don't count them anymore. I don't keep track of them anymore. I let them encourage me. Some days they come on the right day, and the Lord uses that. But people who decide to put more into life than they ever hold up, they've given up counting their thank you notes. And they're the kind of people that are always putting the spotlight on the people around them, not on themselves. They're always just lifting people up all the time. I put a little verse, we end with this at the end of your notes. I don't know who wrote it. Because we children of Adam want to be great, he became small. Because we will not stoop, he humbled himself. Because we want to rule, he came to serve. And that is Jesus hitting us right in the middle of the me first problem and saying, I got a very different way for you to live. If you live the Jesus way, once in a while, I'll sit in a big crowd, like at a sporting event, or I'm in a crowded store. Once in a while, I'll just think to myself, I'm trying to live for Jesus. And actually, my lifestyle is very, very different than most people in this place. Because this is going to put you in the minority. Most of our culture doesn't think this way. But Jesus wants to do something incredibly eternal through your life. That's why we call them paradoxes, because they don't tend to make sense in the cultural world. Worldly way, but these are the ways in which true influence and life is released in us. We renounce the myth the world owes us something. We resolve to put more into life than we hope to take out of it. And Jesus put himself at the front of that train and said, because I didn't come to be served. I came to serve and to give my life as a ransom for many. And he did that at the cross. I mean, no world religion has its God making himself vulnerable. I can't think of one world religion other than Christianity that has its God making himself vulnerable and saying, when you go into a restaurant, who's the most important? The customers. You're absolutely right, but I came to be the waiter. I mean, I know no religion on the face of the earth like this. This is why the gospel of Jesus Christ is so elegant. He served us. So like the choir sang, we can be clean. He died for us. Before we loved him, he loved us. He died in our place. He became our servant. Jesus said, not so with you, pushing people around and lording it over. God, I want you to watch what I'm going to do. I'm going to come to not be served, but to serve. I'm not going to be thinking about how people are serving me. I'm going to come to serve the world, to give my life a ransom, to give my life away so that I could make a way for you to know me. And that's exactly what Jesus did for all of us. I'd like you to stand with me, please.